Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Earlier this hour, we discussed protests against the coronavirus stay-at-home orders, as well as with a Tufts Medical Center epidemiologist about the importance of social distancing and keeping people safe. Joining us now on the line is Joan Donovan. She's the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center, and she focuses on online extremism, media manipulation, and disinformation campaigns. Joan Donovan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So what we want to talk about today is the role of misinformation in the time of a pandemic. So are you listeners, are you seeing misinformation about the coronavirus and COVID-19? How are you separating fact from fear in this pandemic? Where is your confusion and how do you make sure you've got good information? Call us and ask questions or share your thoughts. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Joan, let's just start. Are you concerned about the flow of quality information available to people, at least here in this country during this pandemic, or are we in pretty good shape?
Oh, dear. Yes, we are very concerned about the flow of information right now. The World Health Organization has declared that there's two crises going on. We have the pandemic, which is where the hospitals are being hit hardest on the front lines, dealing with a medical anomaly, right? There's not even a generation of doctors you can look to that have been through a pandemic that can help younger doctors understand where we're going. But the infodemic is what the WHO describes as the overabundance of information, some accurate and some not, that makes it hard for people to find trustworthy sources and reliable guidance when they need it. And that really means, like, what happens if you search, you know, on Google, for instance, for what are the symptoms of coronavirus? Do you get reputable information when you need it or not? And you might not get reputable information if you search for how do I get tested for coronavirus. There's a lot of scams out there that are trying to sell at-home testing, which doesn't exist.
So Joan, at the beginning of the hour, one of the things that we talked about were protests against shelter in place, economic shutdown, etc. Many of the arguments that we heard were based on real economic hardship, real concerns about civil liberties, et cetera. There has also been a line of discussion about those protests suggesting that some people may be participating in them based on lack of quality information about what the risks really are, or, and I think this is an even more important point to ask you about, because people don't trust that the information coming to them, whether it's from the government or from media sources, is quality information that is not being manipulated for some particular end. What do we do when we're in that moment?
You know, in calmer times, maybe people would trust the experts in this situation, but we are already enmeshed in a highly polarized political environment. But for people to trust the science, they have to trust the scientists. So undergirding these reopen protests, we've seen people, you know, we've seen the videos, people are not social distancing, they're not wearing masks, and they're chanting Fire Fauci because they know that the president is getting his information from his medical advisors. And then governors also have a set of medical advisors that they are getting their information from. And so the basis of these protests is medical misinformation, that they do believe that somehow the experts are part of this grand scheme to crash the economy. And the kind of conspiracy theories that we're seeing around this have a lot to do with political polarization and then not trusting medical recommendations. But I hear people about their concerns about civil liberties, and there are responsible ways to protest right now. I have seen people, protest in their cars and drive their cars around a state house and put up signs on their cars. I think there are ways people can express their anger, but do so responsible in a way that's responsible to their health.
Just before the break, we were talking with Dr. Shira Daron at Tufts about how this is an evolving situation, what we do know and what we don't know. And that can actually, over time, lead to differing guidance. Does that change in guidance or the differentiation in guidance, maybe even depending on who you're hearing it from? In your research, does that lead to confusion and to lack of compliance in the public?
Definitely. So let's take, for instance, the controversy around the change in advisory around masks. Some people believe that there was a change in advisory because the science had evolved. That's what I tend to, that's what I believe, is that we did eventually have science that was showing us that it was airborne and that we needed to take greater precautions. The earlier rationale for not having people wear masks scientifically was about the way in which wearing a mask doesn't necessarily fit your face really well. And so people will touch their face even more by wearing a mask. If that explanation is insufficient for you, and depending upon who you hear it from, you may in your mind choose to believe some other explanation. The other explanation that we've seen is that the government was trying to prevent a run on N95 masks and on PPE. However, that happened anyway, right? Despite the medical recommendation. And so I do believe that the mask recommendation could have been handled much more smoothly, but at the same time, it's really hard to actually get your expert information into the public's hands, given the abundance of misinformation and conspiracy that's already out there. It's really hard to get at your audience these days.
So what about people like J.R. Hull, the former representative that we heard from at the very beginning of our show, who for him in organizing a protest, it wasn't about trusting or not trusting the information as much as, even if the risks are as I'm being told they are, it's just too far. We're just going too far.
You know, as someone who has studied science and scientific communication in the past, I haven't seen a moment really in recent history where this kind of anomaly, this medical anomaly, you know, with this novel coronavirus has really needed precautions like this. However, we can look to other countries and realize this isn't just about the U.S., you know, many other countries that have high rates of infection are doing the exact same protocol. And so I do find it hard to believe that somehow that this is a conspiracy about America in particular, when I see other countries also participating in social distancing and, you know, the stay-at-home orders are really preventing people from going out to socialize, and the, you know, keeping open the essential businesses, of course, is very important. But the people working in those essential businesses, they too are very afraid and don't want to, you know, be caught up in this either. And so I do think that if we're going to have a plan for public health, we actually really do need everyone to cooperate and do the same thing. But I don't necessarily think it's something specific to the U.S. where somehow if we just went back to it would work itself out, because we also cannot sustain the economic devastation of, you know, several hundred thousand people dying at once.
Yeah. Joan, I want to grab a call on that, actually. We've got Sean on the line from Sharon. Sean, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say, you know, I was actually fired during this epidemic, and I can't get unemployment at this time, so I don't know how I'm going to take care
Sean.
Of all the bills, but that's all right. But, I mean, money is metaphysics. Human life is the most important thing, and money exists in order to help improve human life. And if it does the opposite, then we need to do away with it. And so right now, human life is more important than money. And we're proving that as a world. And that's really important. So, you know, I detest these protesters, but the few that there are making me happy, because I understand that there's enough people who are educated and enough people who are civilized enough to realize that that's, and, you know, the president is encouraging this. So the fact that protests are so small, you know, I think that's a testament to our unity.
Sean, thanks for that. I appreciate that call. And it is something I think, Joan, to point out is that the protest people who are concerned about the economy actually are a small percentage, and that actually, despite the wide range of sources of information and the extent to which you can customize your information today, polls show that people are actually like 80% or so of people are in lockstep about supporting the pain that we're all going through right now.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, by and large, my hesitancy here is about the tactic they've chosen, not the fact that I do think we need to put serious pressure on the federal government for more and better services, better cash payouts to Americans, because I think that that is, if we don't, it will lead to more social unrest. And I agree with you that protesters are always a small portion of a population. And I'm, you know, very saddened to hear that the caller lost their job in the midst of all of this. And I do wish that, again, that we weren't in such a highly polarized political environment, because if the parties could come together quicker on the needs of the people, we potentially could shift that. The other thing that's interesting, so at the Shorenstein Center, the executive director, Seti Warren, who is the former mayor of Newton, also clued me into
what... he's a guest of ours sometimes.
Oh, yeah, Seti, and he's great. And one thing he did remark to me that I think is important to understand is that states are really stuck in a strange position because they can't run a deficit. And so states want to do more for their residents, and they really can't. And so we do need to try to figure out, well, is there some kind of exception or some kind of regulation or bill that could be passed quickly that would allow for states to run a deficit in this moment and potentially offer direct aid to residents?
That's Joan Donovan. She is the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center. Joan, I appreciate you coming back today. Thanks,
Tiziana. Appreciate it.